Today is Tuesday, January 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, more than a dozen are dead after a violent terrorist attack in a posh neighborhood in Nairobi.
When those guys came in, they just started shooting. I was in the toilet. Even I didn't know what was happening.
Lawmakers worried about keeping the Russia investigation intact. Grill, President Trump's nominee for attorney general.
On my watch, Bob will be allowed to finish his work.
The government of Zimbabwe cuts off internet access. Also ahead, an iconic American Broadway star dies at the age of 97. It's all on today's International Edition. Whoa.
Move away. Move away. Stay low. Let's go. Let's go. Stay low. Move away.
The sounds of explosions and gunfire blasted their way into a hotel and office complex in an upscale neighborhood of the Kenyan capital of Nairobi Tuesday, killing at least 15 people and sending workers diving under desks to escape an attack claimed by Somalia-based Islamist group Al-Shabaab. Authorities sent special forces into the hotel to flush out the gunmen, and witnesses described the fear and chaos.
I found my colleagues running everywhere. Everybody was just running everywhere. Yeah. So I went to our office. We have an academic office, air conditioned. I hid myself in the fridge. I had been in the fridge.
At least 15 people, as we said, reported killed. The U.S. State Department confirming one of the victims was American. VOA's Carol Van Dam talks to South Sudan in Focus managing editor John Tanza, who is in Nairobi, and describes the chaotic scene.
I had a loud explosion, but we didn't know what was happening. And all of a sudden, we saw police cars heading towards Riverside, which is around the area where Nairobi University is. The medical school is around there. The Australian embassy is also close there. So I saw a lot of police cars heading there. And then we started seeing bits and pieces of information on Facebook and Twitter that there was an attack in Nairobi. When I came to the apartment, immediately I switched to the national broadcaster here, that is the Kenya Broadcasting Corporation, and they have been showing live pictures from the venue of the attack.
We were following on a live AP feed, a video feed, and it seemed like there was sustained gunfire for quite a while.
What we were being told by the national broadcaster is that these guys came into a car, and then one car blew off next to the main entrance, and some of them were inside the hotel, so they started exchanging gunfire in the hotel there. But we don't know who they were shooting because the security forces were not inside the hotel. The Kenyan government has not given out the casualty figures as we speak of now. They are still evacuating people from the building, and the situation is just not clear for now. There are no gunshots. We're not hearing gunshots right now.
Have you heard any group or individual claim responsibility, and if so, who is it?
Not at the moment. There is no official statement out. No group has claimed responsibility, although there are rumors that the Al Jazeera TV has put a tweet out that they spoke to the militant Al-Shabaab, but it's not clear. This is not what the Kenyan media is saying here. The Kenyan media still does not know what is going on, and they're still waiting for an official statement from the government on what has happened.
Some people are speculating that, you know, in order for them to get as far into the hotel as they did, this had to be planned for some time, and they had to have some kind of inside contact. Have you heard anything like that?
I've not heard about inside contact, but what happened is when the hotel was attacked, people were not able to get in there. It's only people who have firearms cannot try find their ways to get into the place. But they came, the police came, security officers came, cordoned the place. And even the area where the hotel is, they cordoned it, shut down the road, and they were busy, evacuating people from the building. Police officers and plainclothes officers are busy trying to evacuate people from the building. But one interesting thing that happened when the operation was going on, the evacuation process was going on, there was a car that was just parked by the roadside, and it had an explosion inside it. And so I could see journalists being told to duck down. It's dark down, and then we had an explosion from that car. But bomb experts have been brought. I can see sniffer dogs from the screen that is streaming live pictures from there. So there's more happening on the ground, and the Kenyan government seemed to be in control because you could see helicopters hovering over the building, troops coming in, special forces are on the ground. So they are still evacuating people from the area.
Describe, if you would, the hotel itself and that complex to outsiders who don't know what that area looks like.
Well, the area is on Riverside Drive in Westland. Westland is an upscale part of Nairobi where expatriates and, you know, rich Kenyans live. So this hotel is housed within a residential area, and there's a restaurant there called Secret Garden, which is frequented by, you know, expatriates and people who have, you know, the buying capital to eat good food in the area. But it's a posh area next to Nairobi University hostels for medical school.
That's South Sudan in Focus managing editor John Tanza in Nairobi. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. envoy in Kabul to advance Afghan peace efforts. The U.S. weighs recognizing Guaido as Venezuelan president. Russia and the U.S. say no progress in talks over the 1987 arms treaty. And why classrooms resemble arcades. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432. So the noes have it. The noes have it. Unlock!
British Prime Minister Theresa May suffered Tuesday the biggest parliamentary reversal ever handed a sitting government, with lawmakers, including more than 100 rebels from her own ruling Conservative Party, refusing to endorse a highly contentious Brexit deal. Still, May remained defiant.
It is clear that the House does not support this deal, but tonight's vote tells us nothing about what it does support.
The government's defeat plunges into greater disarray. Britain's scheduled March 29th divorce from the European Union, the much-anticipated historic vote by the House of Commons of a draft deal which took 2 years of ill-tempered haggling with European leaders to conclude, now throws up in the air the whole Brexit project, with major questions remaining unanswered about when Brexit will exit the EU, how it will do so, or whether it even still will. Analysts say the defeat of May's Brexit plan will give further momentum to a burgeoning campaign for a second referendum from those who hope to get a replay that would reverse the Brexit vote of 2016, which narrowly won. Earlier, I spoke to Anne McNaughton, EU specialist at Australian National University College of Law and Centre for European Studies. This sort of plunges the process of Brexit into chaos. What happens next?
Well, Laurie, I would be a bit inclined to suggest that it's been rather chaotic for the last couple of years. What's going to happen next is, as a result of the fact that the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, tabled the vote of no confidence in the government, that will be dealt with tomorrow. In all likelihood, Theresa May and her government will survive that and they will continue. Now, under a recent amendment to the UK Withdrawal Act, Theresa May is required to bring back a plan B, if you like, to the Parliament in 3 days. Whether that's going to happen or not remains to be seen. I have no indication that she actually does have a plan B or that there is some alternative approach. And certainly there's no alternative agreement with the EU for withdrawal other than what was just rejected by the UK Parliament. So what the situation is now is that between now and the end of March, either the UK simply gears itself and braces itself to exit the EU, so to no longer be a member of the EU, I think it's 1 minute past 11 on the evening of the 29th of March, alternatively to present some sort of a coherent way of dealing with what has just occurred in so far as Theresa May could then go back to the EU, to Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker, and say to them, look, we are managing, in fact, an orderly exit, and we just need a bit more time, and possibly the EU will be willing to agree to a slight extension. So they're the sorts of options that are on the table at the minute. But an alternative to the agreement they've just rejected as a means of managing the withdrawal process is not on the table, and it won't be because it would require agreement from the EU. There's no alternative between the UK and the EU.
It took seemingly forever just to get Plan A in place, so Plan B, it seems crazy that they would have something readily available. And it's also surprising that May is expected to survive this. There's a lot of talk about revoting and that it would probably turn out a lot different, that most people there would vote to stay in the EU. Is it a possibility that they could have a revote?
Well, that raises this question of a second referendum, which has a lot of support among certain sections of the UK. The likelihood, certainly Theresa May has rejected the prospect of a second referendum. The difficulty with having a second referendum is, in fact, the very same one that was with the first referendum, and that is making sure the question that is put to the people is structured in such a way that the people can clearly understand what it is they're voting on and what the repercussions, what the consequences of the outcome of the referendum would be. So even if there were a second referendum, and that certainly isn't going to happen between now and the 29th of March, because it doesn't seem to me that anyone has an appetite for that, even if there were time. The difficulty with that is that unless the question is phrased very carefully and there's sufficient management of the population in the sense of explaining going to the second referendum, why that's happening, how the question will be phrased, what they'd need to vote on and so forth. Unless all of that were managed, then in all likelihood there'd be an even bigger disaster than there is now.
And, you know, the whole Brexit thing, you know, with this trend worldwide of nationalism, it seems like it was sparked by that. And it would be curious to see if there are second thoughts.
As best I can read what I observe from this distance, there are those who do have second thoughts and have changed their view quite clearly. There are those who are still adamant regardless, and also regardless of any potential pain or discomfort that leaving without a withdrawal agreement. There's still some absolutely committed to withdrawal in that disorderly fashion. So the end result is that it's not likely to get the majority of people supporting one position or another. One interesting point, and this is something I think Donald Tusk has made this point in a recent tweet, but certainly it's a point worth thinking about. The UK Parliament has just rejected the withdrawal agreement, which is the process by which the UK would leave and stop being a member of the EU. But they also previously rejected, in just I think the last week, the prospect of leaving with no deal. Now, the only third option in the set of circumstances prevailing at the minute is to remain as a member of the EU. If the UK Parliament does not want to leave with no deal, and does not want to leave with this deal, and the 29th of March is effectively just around the corner, well, the third option actually is to revoke the Article 50 and remain a member. Now, I'm simply making that observation as the state of play. I'm not saying that that is likely to happen, and nor am I necessarily advocating for one or other of the positions. I'm simply saying what's on the table at the moment.
All right, that's Anne McNaughton, EU specialist at Australian National University College of Law and Centre for European Studies. U.S. President Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General William Barr Tuesday pledged to shield the special counsel's Russia probe from political pressures and took issue with Trump's labeling the investigation in his inner circle's contacts with Moscow as a witch hunt. Barr told the Senate Judiciary Committee at his confirmation hearing to become America's top law enforcement officer that he doesn't believe Mueller would take part in a witch hunt. And he said he intends to let the probe run its course and that the results should be made known to the public in Congress, though he wasn't specific on how that would be done. Barr said firing the special counsel, though, is highly unlikely.
Under the regulations, Bob Mueller could only be terminated for good cause. And I, frankly, it's unimaginable to me that Bob would ever do anything that gave rise to good cause. But in theory, if something happened that was good cause, for me, it would actually take more than that. It'd have to be pretty grave, and the public interest would essentially have to compel it.
Some Democrats are concerned about that very possibility, citing a memo Barr wrote to the Justice Department before his nomination. in which he criticized Mueller's investigation for the way it was presumably looking into whether Trump had obstructed justice. Barr sought to reassure Democrats he will not be a loyalist to the president, who has appeared to demand it from law enforcement. He also repeatedly sought to assuage concerns that he might disturb or upend Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation as it reaches its final stages. We earlier spoke with Los Angeles-based civil rights attorney Ed Lyman and asked if he thinks that so far Barr has made his case to satisfy Democrats' concerns that Barr will be independent of the president.
He was asked the issue of the Mueller report and how that would be handled if he does become the attorney general. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was troubling we had seen Democratic senators ask about is whether we would get to actually see the full Mueller report ourselves or whether it first be filtered through his office if he does become the attorney general. And there was a lot of equivocation back and forth when Senator Blumenthal had asked him those questions. But we saw later Senator Feinstein hammer away at that and get really specific and say, hey, are you going to turn this over directly to us? Will it first be filtered through your office? And will you make any edits or changes first? And he just said that he would keep the discretion in his hands to do that at the time, you know, that the issue is presented to him. So we didn't get a clear answer whatsoever from him about whether we, the public, mm-hmm. would get to actually see the full Mueller report.
It sounded to me like he was saying it would be his report on the report.
Well, he would have the authority to release the, you know, the report in its entirety if he wanted to. I don't see that there would be any problems unless there was certain pending national security risks or any issues like that. Or perhaps there's other investigations spun off of this one, and you might want to keep certain things from the public while those run their course.
So it sounds to me like he didn't really do enough yet to win over the skeptics, that there were a lot of answers that were not really definitive answers. What about the issue of the ability to indict a president? Right now, it's not law, but it's a rule from the Justice Department that sitting president cannot be indicted. I heard someone ask, why did a president take the oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution if he's theoretically above the law and couldn't be indicted for committing a crime?
Right, a lot of the conjecture we hear about whether a sitting president can be indicted, you know, emanates from the Nixon era and the legal counsel's office of the Department of Justice back then, where they're kind of issuing an opinion saying, hey, we don't think that a president that's sitting should be indicted because it could interfere with his duties during office. So we see that, and that was repeated during the Clinton and Monica Lewinsky scandal as well. This question came up again. But there's no definitive statute or rule of law that suggests a sitting president cannot be indicted. And not to mention, this is just a Department of Justice policy stated in a memo from the 70s, and it doesn't preclude any state government from indicting the president on criminal charges whatsoever.
The likelihood is that the Republicans have enough votes to get him confirmed regardless of what the Democrats do?
Right, and I think if the Democrats, even if they're not so excited about this nominee, the question might be is what's the alternative? I mean, it could be worse. It could be somebody more acrimonious, I suppose, or somebody with bringing more conflict to the situation. But I don't think there's a really good alternative for the Democrats regardless. It's probably just best to confirm this person now and move on and move forward because they're not going to get anywhere either way. And Trump's next nominee would be probably even worse than this one. So I don't see that there's any easy resolve for Democrats in the Senate right now. It's almost a catch-22.
All right. Los Angeles-based civil rights attorney Ed Lyman, thanks for your perspective. Zimbabwe's government has shut down internet access as violent protests continue to spread across the country. Many users are unable to access Facebook and the popular Facebook-owned instant messaging platform WhatsApp. Twitter and Instagram have reportedly also been affected. The protests erupted after President Emmerson Mnangagwa's announcement of a 150% rise in fuel prices last Saturday. Mnangagwa defended the decision yesterday at the start of a five-nation tour. Reporter Kudzai Zvinavashe is in Harare and spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the internet shutdown.
The internet has that has been shut down. We are currently in the dark right now. There's no way of telling what's happening unless if you make a call or a text. We are currently in the dark now.
And what is happening on the ground right now with this internet shutdown?
Well, the internet shutdown is coming after the first day of what's meant to be a three-day shutdown, which was called by the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, the CTU. So this is mainly coming from the president's announcement that fuel prices will be going up starting midnight of Saturday last weekend. So people are protesting against that and the general high cost of living we have experienced in the past weeks. These are some of the issues that have inspired this shutdown, considering the violence that characterized the first day of the stay away yesterday.
Now, there were several people killed yesterday when police in Harare and Bulawayo, they fired live ammunition at protesters. Is that correct?
It is correct. There are a lot of cases of gunshot wounds. I was on the phone with Zimbabwe Association for Doctors for Human Rights, and they are saying by end of day yesterday, they had recorded 26 cases of wounded people, wounded from gunshots. While the number of how many people have died isn't exactly available at the present moment, some have been confirmed dead.
And what are people doing now to try to actually just make a living since they're not able to get to work?
The people are stuck in between a rock and a hard surface right now. You can't go to work because yesterday there were also reports of protesters who were harassing those people who were going to work, saying, "We said we are staying away. Why are you going to work?" So a colleague of mine was covering in Kwazana, one of the hotspots where there was a lot of violence and barricaded roads. He had to pay for passage at every barricade that he went through, and he was threatened with violence. So there's no going around this one. We will have to stick it out, wait for 3 days and see where it goes. But the way the government is dealing with this by shutting down the internet, they have made sure that the shutdown cannot be prolonged in any way because people have no means of communicating. So that means after 3 days, people will just have to assume that the stay away is now over and they'll go back to work. But if they turn on the internet, we may see another case where there is a follow-up action to say, let's do another shutdown in the coming week or let's do a protest or something like that along those lines until government maybe hits to the call to reduce the fuel prices and the high cost of living.
All right, that is reporter Kudza Zvinavashe in Harare. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. Preliminary numbers from the U.S. Department of Agriculture suggest that the population of domesticated U.S. honeybees is still declining. The loss in pollinators is due in part to the effects of pesticides, but also to natural stressors like the varroa mite, which can infect whole bee colonies. To learn more about how to monitor the health of hives, researchers and the computer technology company Oracle are joining forces. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Hasn't got much honey in it yet.
London beekeeper John Davy is taking part in a unique experiment to gather information from bees all over the world.
We have two cables, two wires. One is connected to a probe which is reading the humidity inside the hive. One is to read the temperature inside the hive. These things are all critical throughout the season.
Other probes monitor the sounds of the hive and send all that information into a giant cloud computing system designed by the technology company Oracle. The company is working with the British nonprofit World Bee Project, run by Sabiha Malik, to make sure these insects continue to pollinate the food we eat.
And this is the link we very often most of us forget to make. So bees are not, don't exist merely to make honey. Bees pollinate. And without pollination, we cannot produce food. It's as simple as that.
All of the information gathered by the sensors is analyzed by artificial intelligence in order to learn how to identify healthy and unhealthy hives. John Abel is with Oracle.
We can load in mapping data, road data, pollution data, the industrial park where our hives are. We can see the relationship to a railway, to a river. All of this gives an indication of the hive's ability to be sufficient and healthy in the context of an area.
But data from one hive won't provide enough information for analysis, so Oracle wants to create a giant network of plugged-in hives. That way the system can compare them and learn even more about maintaining healthy colonies.
Because we're using an open connection, anybody can connect and pass us data. And as more and more devices come connected, we get more streams of data. We need billions of rows to make the model self-sufficient.
By self-sufficient, Abel envisions a system that gives beekeepers a warning when things aren't right in their hives and provides data for researchers to determine where bee colonies are most likely to thrive. And thriving beehives means more food.
They could take the data that we've got and understand how they can build a biodiversity ecosystem that allows better pollination to mean that they create more food for their own country or their own neighborhood or even for the world.
The bee monitors are relatively cheap, Abel says, inviting beekeepers who want to hook their hives up to the system to just get in touch. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Swell, Manny, I can tell. Danny, you're still glowing, you're still crowing, you're still going strong. I feel.
Broadway will dim its lights Tuesday night to honor musical comedy legend Carol Channing, who died Tuesday in California at the age of 97. Channing was a lanky, ebullient musical comedy star with big eyes and a raspy voice. She delighted American audiences over 5,000 performances as the scheming Dolly Levy in Hello, Dolly! On Broadway and beyond. Besides Dolly, Hello, Dolly!, Channing starred in other Broadway shows, but none with equal magnetism. She often appeared on television and in nightclubs, and for a time partnering with George Burns in Las Vegas and a national tour. Her outsized personality seemed too much for the screen, and she made only a few movies, notably the first traveling sales lady with Ginger Rogers and Thoroughly Modern Millie with Julie Andrews.
You're still going strong. We feel the room swaying, for the band's playing.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a great day.
I went away from the lights of 14th Street and into my personal haze. But now that I'm back in the lights of 14th Street, tomorrow will be brighter than the good old days.
Those good old days! Hello!
To see you, Hank. Stanley. Lose some weight, Stanley. Dolly's overjoyed and over.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.